I'm Jennifer. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's January 12th of 1992. I have a sponsor, and I actively sponsor women. My home group is the Midtown Group. We meet in Wilmington, North Carolina, Mondays, Thursdays, 7 o'clock. Would love to have you. Come see me. I have an extra bedroom. I love my new friends that I've met this weekend. And it's just been an awesome trip. It's been great to listen to some of the challenges that, you know, you have here in Norway and the wonderful people that are trying to get sober, that are staying sober. It's such a blessing to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to travel, you know, all the way over here and feel like I'm at home with my people. Thank you for making me feel so welcome. Thank you to the committee that has done an amazing job for a great weekend for a bunch of alcoholics that get together and fellowship and get filled up, because that's my experience. When I go to conferences, when I go to service assemblies, I also love that the theme is the common welfare, because I think our traditions are so important. And hopefully I'll share a little bit tonight about my service and how those traditions have played a role in my life and my relationship with God and how all of that kind of enmeshes, because I feel like our three legacies are just, it's the reason I get to live a wonderful, beautiful life. And if I didn't, I've gone through periods of time in my sobriety that I was very active in service, but I wasn't writing inventory, and I felt like I was dying on the inside. Because this alcoholic right here, who and what I am, how many people were here last night? Okay, better. How many people were not here last night? Oh, wow. See, I'm conflicted. Like, do I tell a little bit of my story so you get the gist? I feel like I should. So I grew up in Texas, right outside of Dallas area, and I just had a really rough upbringing. I'm going to fast forward through a lot of this stuff, but just to give the people who weren't here last night a little bit about me, my alcoholism, and what brought me to the rooms, because I think it's really important to qualify, especially if there's somebody that's new here. I would go to meetings in the beginning, and speakers would speak, and I would be glued to what they said until they started talking about recovery, and then it was like, wah, 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 wah. Like, I didn't understand it, because I didn't know anything about being sober, and none of that stuff made sense to me. But I understood when people talked about their drinking, and I understood when they talked about the insanity of the way that they thought. Because when I got here, I could not sleep at night. I would try to go to bed, and I would lay in bed, and my head would just race, and I just felt crazy all the time. Alcohol is what numbed a lot of that insanity that went on in my head. And I can tell you that that insanity can come back to me in sobriety if I'm not actively working steps, and I'll talk a little bit about that as well. But I grew up in Texas outside of the Dallas area. My older brother and I were thick as thieves. We ran around together. I was a tomboy. I hated my red hair. Used to rip it out. And the thing about this, too, is in Texas, everybody has big blonde hair. Like, if you've been to Texas, you understand. And, like, my mom is this tiny little petite thing, big blonde hair, and I just felt so inadequate as a human being. And that was just this exterior thing that separated me. What I didn't know is that if I had had a different color hair, it wouldn't have made a difference, because I was in here empty. And I just didn't respond like normal kids did. And I have nephews now. My brother had two children that I get to watch them, and I can watch their little faces, and I'm like, oh, my God, I get what you're going through right now. Like, we have to keep AA going for those two little ones, because one of them, we just got to keep him out of prison. And then the other one, like, I feel his emotion, because I see that, and I just think, man, I remember feeling that way. He's so sensitive. And I was so sensitive. Like, everything would hurt and crush me. And I always said that I was shy. Most people who know me say, there's no way that you're shy. What I know today is I wasn't shy. I was terrified. I was scared. I didn't know how to talk to kids. I just didn't know how to. And so I stuck with my brother. He was like my little blankie, you know. So I ran around with him. My first drink was when I was 8 years old. My mom gave me a beer, and, you know, I felt like I'd finally arrived. My mom was active alcoholic for most of my life. She has, I think, 18 or 19 years sober now. And about 12 years ago, my mom started learning how to be a mom and showing up in my life, which has been a really beautiful thing. She's my person. I love her so much, and I get to go to conferences with her. My friends hang out with her when I'm not around, which irritates me. I had a sponsee. She came in town for, they had a big celebration for me this year for my 30-year anniversary. And my mom came in town, and I had her speak for my anniversary. And my sponsee afterwards said, "Oh, my God, if your mom lived here, she would totally be my sponsor, not you." I was like, my God, take the dagger out of my heart. But my mom's awesome, and we get to share this life in recovery, which is a beautiful thing. But growing up, she was not reliable. I never knew if she was going to be there, and she was the person who I wanted to be. She was the cool mom, you know, was totally inappropriate things that you shouldn't do with your children. Like, we would watch terrible movies like The Exorcist, and I mean, we were like 5 and 6 years old, you know what I mean? Like, she was not the greatest mom, and she would say that if she was here. But nonetheless, she was the person I wanted to be with. So when she handed me that beer, I was like, oh, and my favorite place was where she worked. It was an old Irish pub. Your feet would stick when you'd walk across it. It smelled like urine. It was just like this gross place, you know? But I loved being there, and I'd wipe the tables down, and I just wanted to be a waitress. So that was kind of the stage that set me up for what would then happen whenever I got to really experience the effect of alcohol. Because the house that I lived in was abusive, it was insanity, and very painful as a kid. Like, I just wanted to disappear all the time. And so when I had that first experience of what alcohol could do for me, I knew it was the solution. It wasn't like a conscious thought, like, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. It was this understanding of, I like that and I want more. And anybody who knows me, if I like something and I want more, it is game on. I am not like stop and go. I'm fast and faster. That's just how I operate. That's how I do AA. I didn't get sober to live a mediocre life. I got sober to have this wonderful, beautiful life, and I want more. And for me, what that means is continuing to work the steps, continuing to grow. Just because I've been sober a long time doesn't mean anything, because I can get just as crazy just like that if I'm not doing the things that I need to be doing. So, I live sobriety like I would if I was drinking my face off, you know? We found this bottle of alcohol. My brother's friend was over. I kind of had a crush on him, and we ran upstairs, and we just kind of inherently knew how to play quarters, and off we went. And that first shot hit the back of my throat, and it was like acid going all the way down, and it hit the pit of my stomach, and I felt like I could breathe. And it was powerful. What would then happen is that I became so intoxicated. They dared me. I couldn't finish the rest of the bottle, and I just turned it up because I like a good dare. And I had alcohol poisoning. I was vomiting blood at some point. I was violently ill. But what happened before that was I was laying on the couch, and everything was spinning. And my brother, he would call me these terrible names, and he was saying these terrible things to me. He was, like, yelling at me. I think I was being loud or something. And I could hear him in my ear holes, but I did not hear him in my heart. And that was what alcohol did for me. It didn't matter what you thought about me. Like, if I was up here loaded, I'd be like, woo! I would have no fear. I would have no anxiety. That's what alcohol did for me, is it gave me the ability to just be okay in my own skin and feel like a human being again. Like, I'd never experienced that. And so from that point until the time that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I drank as much as I could, as often as I could. And I wasn't a daily drinker when I was, you know, 10 years old. But I can tell you, by 11 and 12, I was sneaking out the window. And I was hanging out with people that were 10, 15 years older than me. And then as I got older, I was hanging out with people that were 20 and 30 years older than me. And the insanity, and this is kind of, my whole life was revolved around when I was going to get it, how I was going to get it, and where I was going to get it. And I would do anything and everything. I remember one day, and this was by the time I was drinking every day. I was a daily drinker. I drank first thing in the morning till, you know, I would pass out. And when I would go to school, I would do other things like substances to get me through the day. And I'd gone to school, and somebody had given me a handful of something that I'd taken. And I got really sick, and I started vomiting, and they sent me to the nurse. And they sent me home, and I was like stressing out in the nurse's office because I'm like, it's Friday night, and I can't let them know that I'm sick. Like, I knew I wasn't really sick, and I was like, they can't know that I'm sick because then I won't be able to go out. So I'm planning and scheming, like, how am I still going to be able to go out? And so I got home, and I was like, man, that sour cream at school, like, so I did something to my stomach. Like, I'm fine. I just need to lay down and rest. Because I didn't want Grandma to be like, you have to stay home tonight. You're sick. And she bought it, right? Like, my grandmother, she always called me her little redheaded angel. And then when I got sober, she said that my halo hangs around my ankles. And just true. And so, you know, I ended up going out that night, getting totally obliterated like I did every single night. And most of the time, too, I would go out, I would come back home, and then I would sneak out the room, you know, because all my friends, they drove, they would take us, and we would buy liquor, and I would keep it stocked up in my room. I went to rehab when I was 13. What I learned in rehab is drugs are bad, just say no. It was a whole campaign. I was like, okay, check, I got that. It made sense to me. Now I think about that today, and I'm like, I don't know why I thought it was legal for a 13-year-old to drink their face off, but for whatever reason, there was this justification with alcohol. There was always this thing that there's no way a liquid can have power over me. I just couldn't compute it because in my mind, it was like drinking water. Like, it was not the same. And that was a big part of as I drank and then once I got sober, working through that stuff in my first step. And I did that with a sponsor because I still had these ideas when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not come skipping in here going, I have a problem with alcohol and I need your help. What happened is alcohol stopped working for me and I got to a place that I was so isolated and alone. And part of the thing that I loved about drinking was it gave me the ability to be around you all. But I was never around you all. My drinking was by myself at the end. It wasn't going out partying and having a good, and by partying, I mean like drinking so much that I'm then vomiting and like wetting my pants. Like that was partying for me. But I was no longer going out doing that stuff with you guys. I was staying home, sitting against my door, drinking my face off. And basically, I had been suicidal multiple times during this time period. Like, I'd taken bottles of pills before. I cut my wrist. I'd done different things in terms of having that despair. But what it led me to, the end of my drinking, was this despair that I'd never experienced before. Because the pain of life felt like it was going to kill me. And I remember thinking, this is going to kill me. Like, I felt like the pain of the world was literally just going to crush me dead. And I just didn't want to go on. I said I saw no purpose in life. And what I believe happened on January 11th of 1992 is I was given this experience that I believe my higher power intervened. Because at that time, 3 months prior, 6 months prior, a year prior, 2 years prior, I would have told you that the reason I was the way that I was because of my parents. It was because of what happened with my stepmother. It was because of how my father was not around and didn't love me. It was because my mom, you know, wasn't able to be present and didn't fight for us, right? It was all of these things, all exterior, all your fault. That night, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that the world would be better off without me. I just knew it everything within me, I knew that the world would be better. And to this day, I believe that because who I was selfish and self-centered. I never thought about anybody else. The only thing that I did was live to drink and drink to live. Like, that was what my life was about. Thankfully, there were certain things that were not introduced into my life at that time because I wouldn't have made it here. You know, I was fortunate that alcohol was my master And that was the main thing that I, no matter what, every day I was drinking. I was pretty much emaciated at that time. You could count my ribs. I had bleeding ulcers. And, you know, like I remember once I went to rehab and I had this counselor. And after I got out of treatment, he met with me like 6 months later. And he talked about the physical aspect of my alcoholism and how he said, you know, I see kids come in all the time, 14, 15, 16 years old. He said, I've never seen a kid come in, be in the late stages of alcoholism at the age that you were. Most of the time, there's other things that they're in here for. It's drugs, it's heroin, it's this, it's that. He said, you're a real alcoholic. I remember how, the way he said it. It was so cute. He was from Chicago and had this thick accent. You're a real alcoholic, Jennifer. And so, like, that's what it looked like. But what it felt like was that I could not go on. And I did what I, you know, never wanted to do. And I said a prayer. And I didn't believe in God, but I prayed. And I said, if there's anything out there, please let my heart stop. Don't let me wake up tomorrow. And, you know, I think about that today in terms of, like, the correlation. I don't know why I said make my heart stop. And the reason why that's important is because years later I would end up having to have open heart surgery because my entire life I had no wall in between my right and left atrium. And so I was always short of oxygen, which I now blame all my problems on. I wasn't getting enough oxygen to my brain. But nonetheless, like that was a part of that prayer that night. And because I couldn't figure out how to kill myself and make sure that I wouldn't wake up. I just didn't want to exist anymore. And, you know, when it talks about the four horsemen and it talks about bewilderment and the overwhelming loneliness, I've never experienced that since that day, other than the next day on January 12th when I woke up, because that overwhelming hopelessness and emptiness was there. And I happened to get a phone call that day. It was from this girl I was in rehab with. Her name's Abby, and she called and she asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting, and I did not want to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was not on my list for the day. And I started trying to make these excuses, but for whatever reason, and what I believe is because I no longer had a plan. Usually I always had a plan. Like, you know, if it was something to do with I was in trouble at school or if I was in trouble with the grandparents, I had a plan as to how I was going to work that out. If I didn't have enough alcohol, I had a plan as to what I was going to do. I always had a plan. I had no plans, and I think that's essential. For me, it was essential because my ego was gone, my pride was gone, and I had no ideas how to make things better, and I really thought that I was broken. I thought that there was just something within me that was not normal, and I was never going to get better, and I went to that meeting, and it was the Back to Basics group in Arlington, Texas, and it was full of old men with like Santa Claus beards, suspenders, like they were old dudes, you know, and that was back when you could smoke in meetings. The walls were yellow from the nicotine stains, and there was like 10 of them there just chain smoking, right? And by this time, you know, my isolation had taken me to the fact that half my head was shaved off. I wore like black eyes, black lips, combat boots. I was a lovely creature. And I was angry, and you could feel my rage. When I was sober, I would go into blackout rages, and I'd come to, and I'd be on top of somebody just slamming their head into the concrete. That's just who and what I was when I got here, you know? And I, like, go into this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous looking like a wreck. And those old men greeted me, and they didn't show me, like, the coffee's over here. They got a cup of coffee, and they sat it in front of me. And I experienced what I believe is the love of Alcoholics Anonymous, the unconditional love, unselfishness that these men showed me over the course of the next year was amazing. And it was what kept me coming back. Because I didn't believe I was alcoholic. I mean, I said I was alcoholic that night because that's what all you people were doing. But to my innermost self, I didn't believe that, right? I just wanted the pain to stop. I wanted to feel better because I don't like to feel bad. I still don't like to feel bad, you know? I'm all about, I want to feel good. And they asked me, can you make it here tomorrow night at 8:00? And I was like, I can try. And they said, here's our phone number. If you think about drinking, give us a call. I was like, that's weird. And they would stay after meetings, right? And they would share their experiences and they would tell me these stories. And it was a really beautiful experience. Let me tell you, that home group is not the home group that I would choose today. I would never choose that home group as my home group. These guys, and there are certain aspects of it that were amazing. They loved me where I was at. I mean, they let me be exactly who and what I was. And they didn't tell me I needed to dress a certain way. They didn't tell me I had to work the steps a certain way. They didn't do any of that. They allowed me to be exactly where I was at. They also elected me the GSR of that home group when I was 90 days sober. I never went to one meeting. Because I didn't know where the meetings were. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. I certainly wasn't going to ask, because who asks for help? Not this alcoholic. But, you know, they said that it's the most important position in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, I have the most important position in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So what it did is it made me feel important and a part of. And I was a terrible GSR, but it made me feel important. And my experience with the old timers is it's that. If I did something, they would act like it was the best thing that's ever happened in the entire world. Not the case, right? And it continued to happen, like later on, and I'll tell some of those stories about some of my old guys and gals that that came into my life. Because I believe that when we are looking at our traditions, and we're looking at the things that are important, even though that wasn't the home group that I would choose, I believe that that home group was centered in our traditions and making sure that the new alcoholic felt at home. I think that that was their primary purpose, to help no matter what. And I did the things that they suggested, and I started, working the steps. I remember this biker. It's a big, like, burly biker, and I had been working on my fourth step for, like, a couple of weeks, and he was like, shut up and sit down and write it. And I was like, oh, my God, he was aggressive about it. And so I sat down, and I shut up, and I wrote it, right? And what happened as a result of that was, like, I spent months worrying about these things that were already in my head, and all I did was put it on paper. So if you're new and you've never worked a four-step, it's really not a big deal. You're walking around with that stuff all up in your head, and it's way worse up here than it is on black and white. That was my experience. So one of the things my old guys told me when I came in, because they were like, there's five things that you do every day. And I've done these five things every day, and I haven't had a drink. They've been sober 30-something years or whatever. And they said, you got to pray every morning. Get down on your knees and pray and ask your higher power to help keep you sober. I said, I don't believe in God. I said, I didn't ask you if you believed in God. I told you to get down on your knees and ask your higher power to help you stay sober. And I was like, but I don't believe in God. You can get down on your knees and say a prayer and not believe. So again, my experience is I don't have to feel like doing it. I don't have to like it. I don't even have to believe in it. My experience is I've done the physical actions that have been encouraged for me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and 100% of the time, it works. Because when I ask for help, and I receive that help, and I do what that person tells me, for whatever reason, self is removed. I've turned my will and my life over to this human being who's given me direction. And I believed in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. I did all kinds of weird stuff trying to find this relationship with this higher power that they talked about that I don't necessarily always understand. Second thing they told me to do was go to meeting every day. Then they told me to read in the big book every day, to talk to another alcoholic on the phone every day. And then at night, if I hadn't taken a drink, to get down on my knees and thank whatever was out there for helping me not take a drink. And I was like, that seems simple enough. Like, it seems really simple. Like, five things. That's all you got to do. Those five things every single day. And so I did those things. And when things would come up, because I had obsessions, those first 30 days, I had obsessions. I had uncomfortability. I celebrated a birthday, 6 days being sober. It was terrible. It was the worst birthday I've ever had. I didn't know how to... I was so young when I got sober that when you're 15 years old, the only thing that matters to you are your friends. And I had to cut those people out of my life. right? Not that I had a ton of them, but there were still people who, you know, like 20-year-old guys that would like knock on my window that I'd been hanging out with that were my friends. Again, we call those people pedophiles, but nonetheless, they would like call me or whatever, and I had to not engage with that behavior, and that was behavior that had become very normal for me. And so it was really hard, and I had to go to school and just go to school to learn. It was weird. I was not used to that. And I'll tell you, I was a week sober, and I went home and I told my grandparents, I said, I'll kill myself if I have to go back to school. Like, I can't. I mean, I literally felt like the pain, like I was having anxiety attacks. I was freaking out because I didn't know how to deal with what was going on inside. I was so angry and I was so out of control with my emotions. I didn't know what was going on because I wasn't used to being sober. I didn't know anything about being sober. I know all about being drunk. I didn't know anything about dealing with what was going on in the inside. And I checked myself into rehab with, like, I don't know, I think I was like a week, 10 days sober when I went to rehab. And the funny thing about that is that when I went back to school, like, I left and half my head shaved, combat boots, like, I was literally the school, like, mess up, and people let me know it too. And I went to a very prestigious kind of school, like, I mean, these kids got Lamborghinis for graduation type of school, right? That's not how my family was, but that's how a lot of the families that I went to school with were. And I come back to school, and I'm, like, in preppy clothes and, like, little Cole Haan loafers. They were like, where did you go? You know, like, this whole transformation thing happened. Because I was in rehab for, like, 3 months trying to learn how to deal. And I'll tell you, there was a lot of traumatic things that happened, not only in my childhood, but things that happened when I was drinking. Because I'm not hanging out with the cream of the crop when I'm drinking my face off. And Alcoholics Anonymous didn't fix that stuff. What my experience is that I bring the stuff to Alcoholics Anonymous, and where I've been directed is to seek help wherever I need to get help. And, counselors were able to help me with some of those things that I needed help with. Because I'll tell you, my girls sometimes come to me with things. I am not a doctor. I am not a physician. I'm not a therapist. Until I start getting a paycheck, I'm not your therapist. And I tell my girls that if they want to talk about their problems, no. I'll listen to it one time. The second time you call me, you better have inventory written. You know, like, that's how I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, like, that's kind of how I grew up in AA. And so I got, I had gotten introduced into the steps. I was going to meetings at night, and I was going to treatment during the day. And I started having this community, and they would invite us to go do things with them. Essentially, we played Pictionary most of the time, and we'd go out to dinner a lot. And I was always so embarrassed of them. And I think about it now and I'm like, I love going to dinner with all the crazy wackadoos in AA. You know, like, when you look at a table and you look around the table and you're like, how did we all end up here together, right? Like, it's always just such this big conglomeration of people who are just from so many different types of life. And I love that today. And typically when I travel, like, if I'm at a meeting and there's like this crazy person at a meeting, I'm like, that's who I want to go sit down and talk to. You know what I mean? Like, tell me what's going on. You know, like, I want to get to know you. I want to know what's happening in your life in 6 months and 9 months and a year. Because there was this guy that came into our home group. He thought that we could see his thoughts. He looked like Grizzly Adams. Like, not the clean-cut Grizzly Adams, you know, the scruffy, like, not doing well Grizzly Adams. And he would walk around barefoot all the time, and he was, like, real, real overweight. And I would always greet this guy, and he kept coming back, and he got in connected with the guys in AA, the young guys, and he got a job working at the Blimpies, which is like a little sandwich shop, you know. And then he applied to go to the Cape Fear Community College. And then he applied to go to the university. And then he got a real job. And then he was a doctor. When you watch that transformation happen in a human being, it's unbelievable. That's the best show in town for $2. You know what I'm saying? Like, play that all day long. The miracles and the things that happen in people's lives are really unbelievable. And, you know, I think about my old guys. Like, it must have been amazing for them to watch what a train wreck I was. And it makes my heart smile a little bit because I've seen it happen in girls and knowing like they would always say it helps me more than it helps you. And I remember thinking, what are they talking about? I didn't understand that. And then this young girl, she was older than me, but young girl had come to our meeting and they said, you need to go talk to this girl. So I went over and I started talking to her and I just started sharing with her what my experience was. I only had, you know, probably 6-9 months sober. Man, I felt high afterwards. I was like, this is the best feeling ever. I'd never experienced anything like that. And they said, do you know what that is? And I was like, no, but I like it. And they said, you weren't thinking about you. Right? Because when I wake up in the morning, as much as I love all you people, the first thing I think about is not y'all. It's not. I think about me every day, the first thing that I wake up. What am I going to eat? Where am I going to go? What am I going to do? You know, I've got to go here, 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 here. And like, you know, all of the things, that's what starts when I wake up. And so if I'm not centered with my higher power and I don't have my intention for the day and I am not focused on how can I be of service to the people around me, I'm going to continue through that day thinking about me, 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 me. And that's my problem is me, right? So that was my first like act of being able to help somebody else out in sobriety. And it was like, it felt good. I was one of those people that, I've heard people refer to them as takers in AA. You know, they come, they show up for everything. They go to the parties, they, you know, go to the conferences, but they don't do anything, right? And I was that person, for the first, you know, essentially 3.5 years of my life. I mean, I did some little services. I'd clean the ashtrays and things like that, but I wasn't really involved. I was GSR by name only. And so when I moved to North Carolina, I was 3.5 years sober, and I moved to this place. And what happened was, and, you know, through this time, I had these big spiritual experiences that were really powerful. Because when you go from living the way that I was living to living just this really, my life started getting amazing. I started having dreams. I had never had dreams before. I had never thought, like, oh, I could do this someday. I never had, like, career aspirations. I never thought anything. I remember I had this project in high school, my senior project, and we were supposed to make this, draw these pictures of, like, what our legacy was going to be or whatever. And I actually had stuff to put on there. I had never had dreams of things that I wanted to do. And of course, by this time, I wanted to be a counselor and like save the world, because that's what everybody with 3.5 years sobriety wants to do. And so I moved to North Carolina. And of course, they don't do AA right. I hear this amazing speaker who would become one of my giants. And he like spoke to me. He dagger in the heart. He was like, when I'm in a meeting and I don't want to hear, and I'm not hearing what I need to hear what has been passed on to me, I have a personal responsibility to give back. But if I'm sitting in the back judging everybody, the problem's on me. And it was like, that's exactly what I was doing. And he also had gotten sober really young. His story was one of the most powerful that I've heard, you know. And I went up and I talked to this guy after the meeting, and we got connected. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to go to a conference. And I go to this conference, and my life would forever be changed. Because I went to this young people's conference. I know I got my young people up in here. And I go to this conference. It's crazy. Kids are yelling, hooting, hollering. Lots of energy. And I was like, wow. Because I'd never been able to hang out with anybody my own age. I hung out with senior citizens. I did not know how to relate or talk to people. I didn't know how to talk to people. I was shy. I was terrified. Because you weren't going to like me. I didn't know how to talk to you. It felt weird and awkward. And I ended up meeting other people from my city. And we started talking. We were like, how cool would it be to hold this conference like where we live? And what formed out of that was not only did we start a young people's group in our town, which didn't exist, but We got on this committee because they awarded the conference to us. We went to Kinko's. We stayed up all night long making these copies and this formal presentation. We had no information. We didn't know what hotel we could hold it at. We didn't know anything. But we made it sound like we really knew what we were doing, right? Like, we put a lot of effort into it. And the committee, like the advisory council, it was a regional conference, and it was being held in Charlotte, North Carolina. We live in Wilmington, North Carolina, which is 3 hours. So most regional conferences, they're going to go to different states because you have 13 states in your region, so you want it to rotate. They sent it to the same state 2 years in a row because, like, we pulled on their heartstrings, you know what I'm saying? We're good manipulators. And we got that conference, and then we're like, oh, my God, what do we do? Right. We started hosting this conference, and I had never been involved in service that way. And Young People's gave me this vehicle to get involved in service. And we had so much fun. We would just jump in the car and drive to Syracuse, New York. I'd leave. I live at the beach, so it's, you know, warm all the time. I'm like in shorts, and I wake up and there's snow all around me. Right. And I'm in New York. And we had so much fun. I put so many miles on my car just driving all over the place. We had a great time. I was the co-chair of this conference, so part of my job was to get people to come to the conference. That's how I learned how to talk to people. It's being of service. It was having a flyer and being like, hey, why don't you come to our conference? It's going to be so much fun. We live at the beach. And then I would meet all of these people from all these different places, and it gave me a vehicle to be able to talk to you because I didn't know how to go up and say, hey, I'm Jennifer, how are you? Like, I just didn't know how to have a conversation with people. And service is what opened that up for me. And I did that for years. I not only served on that, I served on a lot of young people's conferences, and I learned how to fight. I learned how to fight fair. I never knew how to fight. I would fight dirty. That's how I fought, because I'm always going to win. And my experience on being on a committee and young people's is you're never going to win all the battles, ever. I remember sitting in a business meeting in the chair. They used to always say, y'all are like an old married couple, because we would just like bicker at each other, right? And I remember looking at him, and he was saying something, and I was thinking to myself, he is an idiot. Like, we thought so differently about different topics. But the way he was talking, this thought came to me. He loves Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized that, because it was always about winning, it was always about being right. And in that moment, I realized how to be a part of a committee and to listen to other human beings that have different perspectives than I do and to try to understand where they're coming from. The gifts that I've received in Alcoholics Anonymous make me able to be a good employee, do well in my career. Everything that I learned as the result of being involved in service or from the old timers who taught me lessons constantly. By this time, you know, I had a sponsor that at that time, she would like pat me on the back and say, you're doing so good, because I was really involved in service, right? And everybody knew who I was, and she'd say, keep coming back, you know? And I got to this place because I was just living this life that was deceitful in terms of I wasn't being true to myself, but I didn't know it. I mean, I honestly just didn't know it. But I was looking for the thing is that when I go to step two and I talk about sanity versus insanity, I was living in this place of insanity because I was using other people as my higher power to make me feel good. And if I'm using other things, whether it's money, men, shopping, whatever it is, the bottom line is my higher power is not involved in that situation. I was also, a lot of my service was, even though I was doing all this service work, I was getting self-gratification from it. So everything in my life was being fueled, not by my higher power, but by all these exterior things. And for me, what happened is I hit a bottom with that. I hit a bottom in recovery that was hard. And that's when I heard the crazy woman talking about writing inventory on her dog, and I was like, she's crazy. And I asked her to be my sponsor, and But I'll tell you, she said, and we went through the book, and she said, man, you're living in the bedevilments. You're page 52 all day long. And I read them, and I was like, they're talking about a drunk person? And it was embarrassing, right? Like, by this time, I'm 7 years sober. I'm, you know, Miss AA and Young People's, and I'm just like a train wreck to a lot of people, hurting a lot of people. And I did this inventory. I did another inventory that was Searching and Fearless, and I did a lot of inventory in my first year and a half, 2 years of sobriety. But from that time until that time that I did that next big inventory, I hadn't done an honest inventory of myself. And when I read that inventory to her, one of the things that she had me do was she said, I want you to read I want you to read in first person when it goes into action, when it's talking about the fifth step and how we do that. I want you to read the entire thing in first person. And I don't know if any of y'all have ever done that, but I encourage you to do it. And I can tell you that when I read the line, I can look the world in the eye, again, it was like a dagger in my heart. Because what I realized in that time that was fear was consuming my life. And when I'm seeking power, because I like power, that's the problem, is I like power. If it makes me feel good, that's power. Men, shopping, money, all of those things. It feels good. And if I like it, I want more. And if I'm not seeking power from my higher power, I'm getting it from somewhere. And so, you know, I read that inventory, and you know what? I didn't die over it, right? Like, it was still okay. And I can tell you that a lot of my behaviors also didn't change, right? Because I continued to do things that were, you know, somewhat reflective of my age, but somewhat just, you know, stupidity. And but nonetheless, I had this really powerful experience. I also had the experience where I started becoming willing to write some of the relationships in my life, because my experience to this point, I had written a ton of inventory on my father because I hated him. He never called me at Christmas. He never called me on my birthdays. He never interacted with me whatsoever. And I remember calling her, and I was just crying. I was upset something had happened, and I was angry at him again. And she said, when you're ready to write inventory, give me a call. Click. Now, I don't know if y'all ever want to punch your sponsor, but if you don't, I encourage you to get a new sponsor, because my experiences, every single one of them, I've wanted to knock out, right? I remember the first inventory that I read about my father. It was the same thing. I remember her saying something to me, and rage filled my body. And I was like, you don't understand. Because this is the thing. When I have a resentment, I have a story. And the story is going to be really sad, and you're going to feel really bad for me, 99% of you, except for that sponsor. She doesn't feel bad about anything. And she wants to hear written inventory put through the column. She wants to know what my part is. I don't have a part. I can't tell you how many sponsors told me, you're a grown adult, Jennifer. You could have told me that all day long. I didn't hear it. But that day when she said it to me, I heard it. And I understood it in a different way. And that I was acting like an 8-year-old child that was hurt and crushed. And I think, you know, a lot of times I can be hard on myself about things, because I think that all of those feelings, they were justified. The difference is I'm not normal. I'm afflicted with this thing called alcoholism. A normal person can stay in that justification and justified anger. It will kill me, because eventually I will get to a place that a drink seems like an okay option, or I need relief from that hurt. And whenever I pick up that drink, game over. And so anyway, I wrote this inventory, and she said, you need to pray about this. And I was like, again, I always hate that being the solution. And so I go and I pray, and I get down on my knees, and I'm just crying, and I'm saying this prayer. And all of a sudden, I had this memory flash, this image that popped in my head. And it was my father when I was 8 years old. And my brother and I had ran away from home, and we had to go back into the house to get our things. And all I could envision was his eyes. And all I saw was pain. That didn't make it go away. But what it did was it gave me a little bit of willingness to understand his perspective, that he was hurt. And I don't know what it's like when your kid says, I don't want to live with you anymore. But I know that it did damage. And so it gave me some understanding of him. And so I started doing the work that she suggested. And she was really big about direct amends. But she said, there's a lot of pain and hurt here, and you need to start off slow. And so I started writing these letters. And I did that for a year and a half. And then after that, I started calling him on a regular basis. And that sponsor at the time, she did a lot of corrections work. She would take the message into prisons. And one of the things I learned during the time of, you know, also doing prison work and taking meetings in is no matter what, whether it's Christmas, whether it's a holiday, no matter what, we always show up. Because if we don't show up, those inmates don't get a meeting, right? So I learned about no matter what, your word is your bond, you show up. And that's what writing those letters was with my dad. That's what making those phone calls were with my dad. I didn't want to do any of that stuff. I still felt some level of justification through the process. But what happened over the course of about 2.5 years is that somehow my heart changed. I'm not capable of my heart changing, because my mind is in control of my head and my heart, unless there's something else that's intervening with that. And that happened through the process of being willing to do stupid things that my sponsor told me to do that I thought were dumb. I still think they sound dumb, but I can tell you 100% that they worked and that my heart changed. And by this time, I was able to make direct amends to my father. I meant it with every fiber of my being that he deserved a better daughter than the daughter that I'd been. And when he left, after I had open heart surgery, he left and he called me every day to make sure that I was okay. My dad calls me on Christmas. He calls me on my birthday. Prior to that, he had never made one phone call. A couple years later, I'd gone home. And when I went home, I would always go call my dad, and we would go for a ride on his Harley. And we would always go to Whataburger to get a burger, because that's where I like to go when I go home to Texas, or I used to. And we were riding, and he said, why don't you move back to Texas? He said, you've always been a Texas girl. Why don't you move back? And what I knew in that moment, what my dad was saying to me, and my dad doesn't know how to say these things, but he was saying, I love you, and I miss you, and I wish you were here so that we could ride on my Harley more often. I didn't know how to listen. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to listen. I don't know how it goes from someone who, two people that don't speak to each other, to two people that get to have a loving relationship. Now, my dad's still selfish and self-centered. My dad is who and what he is, as am I, right? We all have our same stuff, but I can tell you that the relationship we have should not exist. And that had my higher power not intervened in my heart, I never would have gotten to that place. I also went through a lot of painful surgeries, and one of those surgeries that I'd gone through, I had a breakthrough with my higher power, because I've always had this thing that, like, if I pray and I do right, then good things should happen, right? And I end up in this place of complete suffering. I was super sick, and like my sponsees would have to come over and help bathe me and take care of me, and they would sit and pray with me, and I was on pain pills, but tears would just run down because I was in so much pain. And I had this overwhelming experience with my higher power. And what I realized in that moment was that God doesn't relieve me of my pain, that God gives me exactly what I need when I'm going through pain. And it was the people in alcoholic. My family doesn't live where I live. They live 20 hours driving distance from me. I have no family that lives where I live. I never went without a meal. I never went without people sitting with me, praying with me, bringing meetings to me. Every day someone was at my house. And I was laid up that time for 3 months. When I had open heart surgery, the lady asked me if I was famous when I woke up, you know, because people were calling from all over the place, making sure that I was okay. My dad got to see that stuff. Those things wouldn't have been possible had I not actively been doing step work and actively involved in service. Because service is this thing that's always given me this opportunity when life shows up, because my experience is life is hard. I don't know about what y'all's lives are like, but my life has been tough. right? Like, I've experienced loss and heartache and, you know, breakups. I mean, all of these things that feel so crushing at times when you're going through that heartache. And sometimes I have a hard time with my higher power when I'm going through those circumstances. And thank God for service. Because if it weren't for service, that's what kind of brings me back to my higher power. Because sometimes my higher power is you guys. It's just something that you say in a meeting that changes my perspective and I can hear differently. It's powerful. So my dad and I started having this relationship and life got good. You know, I've been through different careers in my sobriety. I've had a lot of money. I've not had a lot of money. I've lost everything. I mean, during the 08, 09 crash of everything, I was in the automotive industry and advertising, and it was like I had my dream job. And they got rid of everybody because everybody was getting killed, you know, financially. It was really, really a hard time, and I felt very conflicted and very lost. And I can tell you, during that time, I was still active in service. You know, I made up for the time that I was a bad GSR. I had a crush on a boy. He told me I should be a GSR. And so I went and I was like the best GSR ever because I had to impress the boy. But what I found out when I went to the area assemblies was like, I'm surrounded by people that are in love with AA the way that I love AA. I mean, who wants to give up an entire weekend and sit around and just hash over some of the things that we hash over? You know, like we will kill a dead horse and just shatter the bones, you know? But I found like my people there, and I continued on in service. I was the youngest person who ever served pretty much any of our service positions at our area, because when I went there, there were no young people involved in our general service structure. I think I was 23 when I was registrar, which is like crazy. And I remember I stood for every position, and they didn't elect me to anything. And the last one was the registrar. And I think they were just like, the poor girl, let's give her something and see what she does, you know? She can only mess that one up so bad. But I worked my tail off to show that I wanted to be a part of the area and to serve Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would grab these young girls, and I'd be like, come on, get in the car. It's the whole thing, get in the car, you know? And we would drive 2.5 hours and go to the assembly. I took this one girl. She was literally detoxing. And I took her to the assembly. And, and she would sit and register people coming into the area, you know? I was always throwing people in the car, getting them involved. During that time, I had some guys that I was really... And my seeking for God evolved and shifted and changed through all of this. The guys I was hanging out with, my old guys, they were devout Catholic. I wanted what they had, so I converted to the Catholic Church, right? Because I thought, like, this is it. And during that time, I had this girl that I'd been sponsoring, and I would pick her up for meetings, and I'd be like, good God, I felt like I'd been drinking just from her being in the car. Like, she was, like, stout from the vodka, you know? And she would act like she was still sober, like she would still pick up chips, and she would say that she was still sober. And I'm like, I hope people don't think I'm drinking. Like, she is, like, reeking of booze. She just couldn't stay sober. And it was my anniversary, and on my anniversary, I usually try to do things for, like, my sponsees, or I'll take my sponsor out. Like, I try to do something to get out of myself and not make it about me, because I want to be like, oh, it's my birthday. And so I try to do things to, like, thank the women that have given me the opportunity to stay sober. And so I held this huge brunch at my house. I'd been cooking all weekend long, homemade everything. At that time, I was sponsoring, like, 17 women, and they all came over, and we had this big brunch, and I decided we were going to have a meeting, and the meeting was going to be on what spiritual principle have you applied in your life this year. And the first one to start was the girl that I was picking up, and I was driving 30 minutes to go get this girl every day, and she was drunk every time I'd pick her up. And she just started crying, and she said, I can't get honest. She said, I try not to drink, and I try not to, and I can't not do it. And she just broke down, and, like, of course, after the meeting, all the girls were, like, vroom, all over, you know. And that was a Sunday. And the next day, And during this time, one of my old guys was really sick, and he had moved into hospice. And the previous months, I had the privilege to go and help take care of him a lot of nights during the week. You know, he allowed me to see him in a vulnerable place. And for someone like me, it's really hard for me to be vulnerable and let somebody take care of me. And I know that was hard for him. But he taught me how to accept love, because it's really easy for me to give love. It's really hard to accept that love. He taught me how to do that. So we go to the meeting. This girl picks up her white chip after the meeting, and I'm exhausted, right? Because I had this whole weekend that I did all this stuff for all these girls. And after the meeting, she's like, "Can I come stay at your house tonight?" And I was like, "Jesus Christ, these people won't let me sleep." Like, I'm just like, when do I get a break? Because we'd gone out to dinner and like all the things. And you know, I was like, "Of course, I'd love for you to come over." So I say this again to say, man, sometimes I don't want to say yes. Sometimes I don't want to do the things. But I say yes. And I say yes because I want that new person to feel welcome. And God, I didn't want her to take a drink. So this girl comes over to my house, and I realize midway through, I was like, I didn't go by and see Mikey today. And I said, "Hey, do you mind giving me a ride to hospice? So I just need to run in really quick and say hi to him." And she said, no problem. And this girl was like adamantly against God, okay? Like the hairs on her neck would stand up if you said anything about God. She was anti-God. Mike, he was the devout Catholic, right? He gave everything away so he could pray for people every day for 4 hours. And so we show up at hospice, and we walk into the room, and it was apparent that he was not going to make it. His breathing was so shallow, and we go and we sit down next to him, and we had the rosary, and that was his favorite prayer. He loved the rosary. And so we started praying, and this girl who hates God, right? She's praying the rosary. It's like the most, you know, Christian thing that you can do. And she's real anti-Christian. And we all have our hands on him. And he just starts breathing more and more shallow. And eventually he took his last breath. I felt him leave. She felt him leave. And of course my ego's like, of course I was his favorite. That's why I was here. Okay? So we get in the car and we go back to my apartment, and we're sitting outside, and she said, "I don't know what happened in that room, but I felt something I've never felt before." And she said, "It was this overwhelming feeling of love, and I've never felt it. And I don't know if that's what God was, but I felt it." And in that moment, I knew it wasn't because I was his favorite. I knew that my old guy was doing his last 12-step call. Because that girl hasn't had a drink since. That girl also stayed with me for 3.5 years. So when you tell a new girl that they can come to your house, be careful. I got to watch her become a daughter. I got to watch her become an aunt to her nieces that she used to hide her liquor bottles in their closet. Those nieces now are drinking their faces off, but they have a sober aunt if they ever need help. Her and I aren't like, we don't see each other all the time like we used to. But when we do, it's always good to see her, because we will always be bonded to this thing that we got to experience. And that's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. My old guys, when they're dying, they show up to meetings. I remember Mike used to carry around a pillow. He was so bony. And he said, "You know what? I'm going to be suffering no matter what. I might as well be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." I don't feel like going to meetings a lot of times, but you know what? I think about Mikey, and I get my tail to a meeting. I don't. Lots of times I don't feel like, I don't either want to see people or I just want to stay home, right? Sometimes it feels good just to be home in your comfy clothes or whatever. Through the pandemic, you know, that's one of the things I've seen a lot of, is our members have like struggled getting back to meetings. And it's important for me to be an example, is to show up to those meetings, is to tell my sponsees, sorry, that doesn't work anymore, because they know me well enough to know that you better be dying if you're not going to your home group. And so, you know, like, I've gotten to experience these amazing things. I got to take care of this woman who was an old-timer in our area. She asked me to be her power of attorney and to help her because both her daughters died. I got to hold her hand when she took her last breath. I got to advocate for her when she was struggling and she wasn't coherent. I was somebody who took people to parties and then I would beat them up when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. The person that I am today is as a result of this God that I don't understand, because I can tell you that a couple years later, one of my best friends died, 39 years old, of cancer. I would get in the car Friday night at 6 o'clock at night. I would drive 6 hours to where she lived. I would stay with her till Sunday night at 11 o'clock. I'd come home. I'd work 50 hours, and I'd do the same thing over. I did that for 4 weeks in a row. I talked to her about God. I asked her if she was scared. We had conversations. I got to be a friend to her. I know I'm a good friend today. God's given me the ability to show up in people's lives in beautiful, amazing ways. But I can tell you that was one of the most painful, hard things I've ever done in my life. I didn't understand why she had to suffer the way that she did, because it was the worst thing I've ever watched. And I've been with lots of people when they died, but I've never seen somebody suffer the way that I saw her suffer. She was 39. It was terrible. And I got really angry with God. I was like, y'all are all just saying that there's a God because y'all want to make yourselves feel better. Because if there is a God, nobody would do what happened to her and watch that happen, like let that happen. And people would say things like, oh, she's hanging on for something. No, she is not hanging on for anything. She's 39 years old and she has a strong heart because she was a runner. And her body hasn't died yet. But I was angry. And I went to a really dark place in my recovery. I was still active going to meetings. I was still super involved. You know, I would do my step work. I talked to my sponsor on a regular basis. But I thought this God stuff is just not real. Maybe it was real at some point in time in my life. I don't know, but it's not real. And then I got this new sponsee. And this girl she was terrible, right? She was like me when I came in. She was defiant. She was like, had all these ideas, and she was just like young and spunky and just energetic, you know? And I knew, I gave her 5 things that she needed to do. And I walked away and I thought to myself, man, it's going to be hard for this girl to get down on her knees and pray. And I thought, I don't even remember the last time I got down on my knees and I prayed. And I said, you know what? I'm going to do it for her. I'm going to pray for her because I know it's hard for her. So I started getting down on my knees and praying every morning. It was physically uncomfortable, not for my knees, but like my insides. I did not want to be on my knees praying. I felt an internal rebellion to that physical act for about 2 weeks. And then it became my favorite thing to do, because it was the one time in the morning where I felt like I could breathe again. I was sitting there praying one day, and I was kind of just in that space, and I was thinking about whether God is or God is not. God is everything or God is nothing. And I'd been living in this space that God is nothing, and it was dark. And I knew in that moment, maybe it's all made up. Maybe I am saying it to make myself feel better. But I can't live in a place that there isn't a God. So God has to be everything. And so I made a decision that day, and I said, God is everything. And I also made a decision that I don't have to figure it out. Because I've done sweat lodges with Native Americans. I've like gone to the Buddhist temples. I've gone to the Catholic Church. I've gone to, you know, the big massive church thing. I've done all sorts of things looking for this higher power. My experience is that none of that stuff fit for me. I still will go to it, enjoy it with my friends and stuff like that. What fits for me is that there is something bigger than me. I don't know what it is. And the most simple prayer that I can say and always reconnects me is help. That's what I got when I got here. I prayed to crystals. I've done all kinds of stuff. Help. Getting on my knees has nothing to do with a religion. For me, it's this act of submission that I do to remind myself that I am not in control of my life, and that when I am in control of my life, I'm a highly competent human being. I'm one of those people, if somebody wants something done, they come to me because they know I will move mountains and make it happen. The problem is that because of this self-reliance, it blocks me from being my full potential. And my full potential is when this light is able to shine in my heart that comes from this higher power that I don't understand. But I don't have to, because when I do the deal, it shines in my life. My hardest times in recovery, service is what has always been the thing that brings me back. When I was delegate to the General Service Conference, that was the hardest year of my life. It was also one of the best years of my life. I remember being at the General Service Conference and I just could not believe it. I felt so honored and privileged to be in that room, and it was amazing. When I got home, tragedy hits my life. I was getting ready to be engaged to this man who I could feel the presence of his love when I was in his presence. And he basically met somebody else, right? These tragedy things happen in our lives. But I had never experienced a heartbreak like that. I cried every day for 4 months. I'm not a crier. I thought I was never going to experience joy again. There's nothing worse than heartbreak, right? It's terrible. But I had this service commitment. And that service commitment is what gave me the ability to connect again and not to become divided. Because when big tragedies happen, I become conflicted. Because it's so much easier to blame God than just accept that bad things happen in my life, right? Today my life is beautiful. I get to sponsor a bunch of women that are crazy, but they allow me in their lives. They trust me. It's an honor and a privilege. Today is one of my sponsees' 5-year anniversary. I never thought this girl was going to stay sober. I was like, she's not going to be willing. She's been fantastic. It's been beautiful to watch her life evolve and change. The women that get to come into my life and I get to watch them, it's the bright spot of my life. The relationships that I have in my family are mended. I get to be the coolest aunt that has ever existed. All of my friends' kids love me. I never got to have kids, right? But I get to be the coolest aunt. And I love being the coolest aunt because I can give them sugar and send them home. You know, I don't have to deal with anything else. Just keep them alive while they're with me. It's funny because I went through years of feeling lonely, of not having a significant other, not having certain things in my life. And what I feel like today is I'm God's favorite. You know, because I have my dog that I love. She loves me. We come home. We chill. If I leave a cup out, that same cup's going to be there the next day. It's nobody else's. If I want to leave and go out of the country, I leave and go out of the country, right? I have a beautiful life of freedom. And it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because of rooms like this, people like you. I hope you all think to yourself, what is my love in AA? And if you don't know what it is, that you find it. General service was a huge aspect of my life. Young people's was a huge aspect of my life. Right now, I hope I get elected cake person at my home group, right? Because I love baking cakes for people when it's their anniversary, you know? I've done all kinds of things in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can tell you that service is what connects me when life shows up. And life will always show up for us. Because it's not about when I'm drinking, it was bad. Things didn't change just because I quit drinking. What has to change is inside me with a higher power through the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and the service, because I'm God's child and my job is to do his work. And I feel privileged that I get to do that stuff. I appreciate you guys so much. I am done. But thank you for letting me be with y'all this weekend. And yeah, that's it. Thanks.
Thank you for sharing with us, Jennifer. Vi har bedt en venn om å lese den 7.